Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, Larry Mueller here. Glad you're along with us on this Memorial Day as we turn our attention to birds, resident and migrant bird watching in Wisconsin, kind of on our minds. I had some fun this morning looking out on our back lawn area there. We've got two oriole feeders. We had, I think, six Baltimore Orioles attending to both of those feeders and a variety of other birds, a lot of red-winged blackbirds this morning, but a cardinal and some other birds hitting the feeders, and it was really kind of a nice way to begin the morning. Well, a couple of guys that keep their eyes on the birds pretty regularly are our guests today, Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, one of our guests. Hi, Noel.
Good morning, Larry, and good morning to our listeners. And it sounds like you're doing something right in your yard for the Orioles this year.
Yeah, we've got a couple of feeders out there. We had one in the past, and then I got another one, and I thought, well, why not put them both out? And so we've got at least six.
That's terrific.
Yeah, coming to the feeder, so that's wonderful. Bill Volkert, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Larry.
Good to have you back as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bill's a wildlife educator with the Department of Natural Resources based in Horicon Marsh. And Bill, before we get started with calls, and by the way, let me give you the number to join in. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment as we talk birds today with our two guests, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. So chime on in. We'd love to hear from you. And, Bill, I'm wondering, how are the great egrets and the great blue herons doing this spring at Horicon Marsh?
Well, the large colony that existed for many years out on Four Mile Island and then moved to Cotton Island, that was basically blown out and destroyed during a severe thunderstorm about 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So we don't have the large concentrations of birds nesting right on the marsh. There are some small colonies both on the marsh and right nearby, but Horicon is still extremely important in two ways, and that is when these birds first arrive in spring. This is where they refuel and fatten up prior to nesting, and especially after nesting by midsummer when the adults are no longer tied to the nest and the young are out, they come here to really gobble down on the small minnows, frogs, and so forth. And so it's critical for pre- and post-nesting. The other thing is, of course, we're trying to just manage these islands to maintain some good growth out there because eventually these colonies will die out somewhere else, and we'll give them an option to always come back here and take advantage of it in the future.
Absolutely. Well, Noel, we're approaching the prime time for studying resident bird populations here in the state. A number of breeding bird surveys, I believe, are conducted in mid-June. That's a time when the bird songs are at their peak. And I know the North American Breeding Bird Survey is done around that time. Talk a little bit about that.
Yes, the North American Breeding Bird Survey is really our longest-term good measure for what our breeding birds are doing in North America. That's been going on since the mid-60s, so we have now more than 40 years of continuous data. These surveys are done on a roadside route one day during June, which, as you indicate, is kind of the peak of the breeding season. And along one of these roadside routes, people stop every half mile for 50 stops. And those 50 stops are done year after year after year at the same location, same time of year, hopefully by good qualified observers. And when you put all that data together, it really gives us good trend information for what's happening to our breeding birds. Those that are experiencing increases, declines, holding steady, ups and downs from year to year. And of course, over time, we really start understanding what's happening to some of our bird populations. And once we know that, hopefully we can start addressing their needs and do management and other restoration if necessary, or keep those that are doing well continue to do well. So it's a really a great time of year. I've been doing five of these routes. We have 92 in Wisconsin. I've been doing these for now about 30 years, and
wow,
it's really one of my highlights of the June time period.
Oh, it's great fun, and it's also great information. Great to have that data.
Yes,
those
it is.
Data. Well, Eric in Portage has a question, so let's go there. Eric, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, thank you for calling.
Yeah, say, I Had some orioles last year at my place and started feeding them. So lo and behold, this spring I heard their peculiar singing and recognized it and got some feed out and some jelly. And I was just curious as to the probability of them being the same as last year.
Oh, it's probably pretty high. I don't know. What do you think, Bill?
Well, we certainly know that it's very common that birds come back to where they nested the previous year. Of course, they're young that are hatched out. They return somewhat to that area again, and there's mating. The guess is very likely the same one, but since all these birds look alike, the only way to be absolutely certain is you'd have to capture and mark the bird as bird banders do. And that's the only way to know for sure that's the same individual and how many years it's coming back and give us some idea of the longevity. So when we talk about different kinds of research on birds, Noel mentioned the breeding bird surveys. Those are good population data and gives us an idea of breeding bird trends. When we want to find out more about individual species and their populations, how many young are added into the population, how long those things survive, what the turnover rates are between the generations and so forth, you've got to mark individuals. Rarely you will find, say, a bird that is somewhat unusually naturally marked. I had a fellow call me about 3 weeks ago. He has a robin with two white tail feathers. Here's a bird that it stands out from all the other individuals.
Yeah.
That he can always identify, and he knows it's been coming back for 3 years now. Otherwise, I would say we can guess it's very likely the same one, but keep in mind at some point, most of these songbirds live, say, 3 to 5 years on average. One you had a few years ago died out. Another one looking just like it took its place, moved into a vacant territory. So, you know, you live at your house for the next 10, 20 years. There will be these generational turnovers, and without actually marking the individuals, we have no way of knowing for sure.
Yeah. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And let's see. Let's turn to Laura next in Superior. Laura, hello to you.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have been wondering about peregrine falcons. I think we have had a pair living in my neighborhood here for several years. And I was wondering how I had heard that they are kind of rare. And
wondering their
status.
Wondering if
this is something the DNR likes to know about.
All right. Well, Bill, we can probably Noel and Bill can comment here, but Bill, go ahead.
Sure. Well, peregrine falcon is a bird that there are three populations, a western, an arctic, and eastern. The eastern population is extinct. Essentially, DDT wiped out those birds from exposure, and we began then a reintroduction using some of the other subspecies of the falcons to bring them back to Wisconsin. And this was essentially a hacking program where the young are raised to a certain age in captivity. They were then put out into boxes, nesting platforms, watched carefully. And over the years now, they've not only established themselves, we've provided other structures for them. And with that, the population now is somewhat self-sustaining. We've got a fair population of them nesting along the lakefront where a number of these structures were put up. And in the last few years, a couple of the traditional cliffs along the lower Wisconsin and the Mississippi River. Superior area, we know we get falcons, peregrine falcons that come there in wintertime. They'll hunt around the harbor and around the granary. I don't know of nesting pair there. It's very likely with some of the taller structures around the harbor that perhaps a nesting platform was put up for them. There is an annual survey that is conducted. Greg Septon, who is with the Milwaukee Public Museum, worked very intensively with that project originally and still does. And Sumner Madison, our avian ecologist for endangered resources, keeps track of the data for DNR. We're certainly looking for any new population so we can get a bird like this, almost the exact count of it. Also keep in mind for the North Woods, if you haven't got the tall structures, merlins, or what it was called in the past, the pigeon hawk, kind of a mid-sized falcon, is another possibility up in that region.
Yeah, I'm sure. Comment from you, Noel.
Yeah, just before you called me, Larry, to get on the show today, I was looking at We Energy's webcam, because we have the peregrine boxes at four of our power plants all geared up with webcams, and I just happened to be looking at the Port Washington one, which is near where I am in the office here this morning, and I can see the on the 11 o'clock picture from today, I can see the adult feeding the four young that are inside the box. You can see this on the webcam. A picture is taken every hour. And in fact, Bill mentioned Greg Septon. Greg would be banding these peregrines this next week, so they're just getting almost to that age where they're being banded. And it's a terrific way for people to keep an eye on what's happening in the family life of peregrines by viewing the webcams. And she mentioned, Laura mentioned Superior, that there was one that tried to nest a few years on one of the bridges in Superior. To my knowledge, that's the only location in the Duluth Superior area where they have attempted to nest is on one of the large bridges.
Mm-hmm.
She has a hawk right in her neighborhood, in a woodsy area or in just regular residential areas. It's probably a Cooper's hawk and not a peregrine. Peregrines are lovers of wide open spaces. They're going to nest out in the open, near water if possible, up in high locations. So I guess it just depends on where Laura lives.
I'm in a residential area, lots of old trees. It's an old neighborhood. But this bird screeches.
Yeah, you wouldn't have a peregrine nesting in a woodland area. They nest typically, as Bill mentioned, on cliffs. And now that we've put these boxes up on high locations on tops of tall buildings or smokestacks, or bridges, they're taking those. You probably have a Cooper's hawk.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's turn to John in Green Bay, I believe, is next. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Morning.
While I was sitting here listening to you, I started making a list of birds at my feeders. And I've come up with over 15. But the reason I called was the white pelicans in De Pere, below the dam. Over the last years, there seemed to be, initially a dozen, maybe a couple of dozen. This year, from my observation, driving across the new bridge, there are hundreds, which have to drive the walleye fishermen crazy. But, and the other thing I want to make is I seem to have the only feeder in Wisconsin that never has a problem with squirrels. someday I'll give the secret formula, which isn't very complicated. But, yeah, we've just had a fantastic number of different kinds of birds, from the Cooper hawks, the indigo buntings, woodpeckers, hummingbirds, red-winged blackbirds, blue jays, turkeys, red-breasted grosbeaks, all the different kinds of finches, orioles.
Wow.
So anyway, it's paying attention to them.
Yeah. That's for sure. And, well, let's get some comments. Bill, we'll start with you on the pelican. By the way, I should mention that 6 pelican flew over our home in Madison the other day, very low, and it was a great sight to see.
They're starting to show up in more places. We've talked about pelicans over the last few years, and it is somewhat of a newcomer to Wisconsin as a nesting population. In 95, they started nesting in lower Green Bay. So the ones at De Pere are from that population nesting in the lower Green Bay area. Cat Island is one of the locations. And these are birds, like a lot of the bigger, old, long-lived birds, that don't nest or mature until about 4 or 5 years old. So the young ones tend to roam a little bit more. Perhaps this is a non-breeding population. Or if you've got a bit of a fish run, perhaps some of these birds are concentrating there. And by the way, the walleye fishermen shouldn't have to fear. They're normally taking more of the schooling fish, such as shad, here at Horicon Marsh, little carp hatchlings, things like that. Also, Horicon Marsh's pelican population is down this year because of the high water. They nest on dry islands, and there's not a lot of those out there this year. And last few years, when we had lower water level, they actually walked into the cattails, stomped them down, and made a bit of a makeshift island. That's flooded. And so I haven't got all of the counts in yet, but we are doing surveys on all the different pelican colonies. And my guess is if a Horicon has diminished because of lack of nesting space, that the site up on the Winnebago chain and perhaps even up at Green Bay, those could be growing tremendously. We saw that in 2005 with the spring floods. The Horicon birds literally packed up and joined the big flock up at Green Bay, and that increased tremendously in size.
Hmm. Noel, comment?
Yes, as Bill indicates, it takes several years for the young to attain breeding age. So you have a number of these pelicans that have been raised here in Wisconsin for the last over 10 years now. So there's a lot of non-breeders, and they float from lake to lake, and we're just seeing more locations around the state, and I guess there's no question that we're going to see breeding colonies being established in new locations as we go along and as this population continues to build.
Absolutely. Glad to be talking birds on this Memorial Day with Noel Cutright, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR's Bureau of Wildlife Management at Horicon Marsh National Wildlife Area. I'm Larry Mueller. Keisha Mabra, our on-air producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you'd like to join in our conversation about birds as we visit with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call, and we'll be glad to get you on the air. Felix in Ringgold, I believe, is up next. So let's go to, let's go to Felix. Felix, hello.
Hello. Hey, starlings, they're illegal aliens, right? I helped a guy put up a martin nest, and we just barely got it up. Proper height, proper holes. We went by the bird people's blueprint. The starlings jumped down the porch and took over. Now, the next morning, I saw a starling hanging, pulling with all its might, fluttering, and here another starling was in the nest, and he had his foot in his beak, and he was pulling back.
Yeah.
It was the most comical sight. Now, how do you stop the starlings from taking over the martin nest? Because that was exactly the blueprint that we were given to make the nest.
All right. Well, let's go to start with Noel here. Noel?
Well, certainly, as you point out, starlings are an introduced species. Both them and the house sparrows are common nesters in martin houses, and that's one of the problems that purple martin landlords have, is dealing with both of those species. And it because of the hole size of purple martins, you know, 2 to 2.5 inches, they can certainly allow entry for both starlings and house sparrows very easily. It takes diligence, and, you know, they can be trapped. It's just a constant battle, and there's really no sure secret things you can do or not do to keep the starlings and house sparrows out, other than if you want to try to trap them out in some manner, because they are not protected by law. Only the introduced species like house sparrows and rock pigeons and house sparrows are not protected by the Federal Migratory Bird Treaty Act, where all of our other birds in Wisconsin, whether they're warblers or sparrows or hawks, are all protected with the federal legislation.
So you just have to keep pulling those nests out or trapping them in some fashion.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of the house designs have a telescopic pull, so there's a little crank on the bottom, and you can lower that down. And some of them actually come with a trap that can be inserted into the apartment where we know that the birds are using it. And in fact, I've got, there's one here that our local bird club's been managing at Horicon. It's got a little red door, so you know when the house sparrow gets in, the trap door drops, you can just look up, you'll see the red flag, kind of like ice fishing, and you know you've caught it. The other thing to keep in mind is if you just keep bringing it down or getting on a ladder and trying to pull out nesting material, they're going to be stacking it back in and trying as hard as you are to keep them out. The real solution is to try to get the culprit itself, and this is always a tough decision for people, but to lower that house at night when they're in there on the nest or roosting in it, and then you can take the bird out and dispatch it.
No.
You've got to watch exactly which apartment, which angle, which corner, and when they're sleeping. That's the time to do it. Excellent information, by the way, from the Purple Martin Conservation Association. You can check on their website. They're out in Pennsylvania. They've got lots of good hints for people who are responsible for martin houses. And they're 100% dependent on people these days, so we've got to take good care of them and give them a chance.
Yeah. Thanks again for calling. Frank in Arborvita, you are up next. Hi, Frank.
Can we go back? Hi, gentlemen. Can we go back to peregrines for just a second?
Sure.
I know Merlins very well because we have them locally here at Trout Lake. And I know Cooper's hawks very well because they're frequently trying to pick off little birds at our bird feeder in Port Edwards. Last year, traveling up Highway 51, we were north of Merrill, about 8-10 miles. And it's a fairly open area there, meadows and so forth. And I saw a peregrine falcon. I've seen falcons in the cities, picking off pigeons and so forth. And I'm sure that this was a peregrine. Why would he be there? There are, as you know, if you know that highway, some super tall billboard structures along the road. And I guess make a hypothesis that they're using that structure as a nest site.
What time of year was that?
I'm sorry?
When what time of year?
That
what?
Was in August.
In August. All right. Well, yeah. Noel, you want to take a crack?
Yeah, you're going to have birds throughout the spring, summer, and fall, and even into winter, birds that are so-called floaters. They're not part of a nesting population. These are going to be adult birds that just haven't been able to find a location to nest yet. Plus, you have young produced from that year. They're going to be floating around. And as Bill points out, depending on the time of year, you're going to have migrants going through. Some of the peregrines that come through Wisconsin are heading for the tundra, far, far north. I was in Green Lake County this past week, saw peregrines going after shorebirds. There's been reports of peregrines going after shorebirds just in the last few days out in Columbia County. So you could see peregrines in just every county in Wisconsin in just about any month of the year, but especially during the spring, summer, and fall. And again, these would be either migrants or young birds or a floating population of adults that haven't settled on a location to breed yet.
Yeah, interesting.
You know, we have a pair of birds, for example, at a power plant and a nest box. They're continually doing battle with and chases, and some of these get pretty intense. It's strongest or survive, and so you get turnover of both adults and females and males at power plant nesting sites almost every year.
Yeah, interesting. Frank, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Randy and Aaron, we'll go to you next. Hi, Randy.
Hello. I was listening with interest to your program, and I felt compelled to call because I'm an avid bird watcher along with my wife, and we made an interesting sighting about 2 weeks ago. It was a blue grosbeak. This was 100% positive identification, no equivocation in my mind. I identified it out of a Peterson field guide. And the field guide indicated on the range map that this bird had extended its breeding range into Illinois. There was a little pocket in the center of Illinois which showed that it was there, but nothing in Wisconsin. So I thought your organization might be interested in knowing that this was sighted. I live in the town of Erin by Holy Hill in Wisconsin. It's near Hartford. And I understand that bird's not commonly seen in Wisconsin.
Oh. Well, Noel, I'll go back to you for a comment.
Well, Randy is certainly right. They are a very uncommon species. We were fortunate on a Wisconsin Society for Ornithology field trip a week ago Thursday as part of our annual convention. We're down in the Sugar River Valley I think it's Rock County. We actually stumbled upon a blue grosbeak at a location we were looking for orchard orioles. But this was
wow.
The exact same location where there was a blue grosbeak 3 years ago. And we talked earlier about birds returning to the same location. We're guessing it's probably the same bird. No one found it there last year, the year before, but maybe they just didn't look hard enough or didn't happen to be there at the right time when the bird was singing. So we get maybe one or two sightings a year, maybe in a good year a few more. A lot of these are so-called one-day wonders. They're here during migration, and they're gone the next day. So as Randy pointed out, it is a more of a southern species, and I guess as things continue to change with our climate, this is a species maybe we can start expecting to occur in Wisconsin more frequently. It's a species that we would love to have submitted to the WSO, the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, so the Bird Records Committee can evaluate it and submit it as a valid record, and it goes into the historic database that way. So he could either email me the record or go to the WSO website. And
what's that website?
Yes, it's www.wsobirds.org, and he can find email addresses of the various folks on there and email the record, and they can get you the information. There's also forms you can download to substantiate this bird. So it's a terrific record, and I hadn't even added to my state bird list a few years ago, and I was fortunate to be on this field trip a week ago Thursday and got to see the bird seeing, and some folks there were able to get pictures of it. So it was an exciting bird. And Randy, that's almost a chance of a lifetime here in Wisconsin.
Well, let me tell you, I will definitely go to the website and report this. One thing about this bird, when I initially saw it, I thought it was an indigo bunting because at first I saw the bird, it looked all blue. And then upon second look, I said to myself, no, that thing's about twice the size of an indigo bunting. They couldn't possibly be an indigo bunting. And I quick got my binoculars and I saw the broad, buffy stripe on its wing with a lighter stripe below. And interestingly enough, that bird is depicted on the cover of Peterson's Field Guide.
Yeah.
So it was an immediate identification. I was so excited I lost sleep that night. I do hope to see it again, and I will definitely report it to your organization. And my wife's here with a pen. Could you give me that website again?
It's www.wsobirds.org.
Okay, real good.
All right. Thanks a lot, Randy.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. And we'll turn to Stephen McFarland next. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning. How are you guys today?
Great.
My mother-in-law, Betsy, in Dodgeville, Wisconsin, asked me to give you a call. We have two, I think, are somewhat unusual birds we've had here. One is an all-white robin with just a hint of orange on its chest. And I wondered how unusual that was in this area, and we do have pictures of it, and if anybody was interested.
Okay, Bill, comment?
I had actually an albino robin earlier this year as well, and I've heard reports over the last few weeks of grackles and blackbirds with white on them. Whenever you've got especially a very large population, such as robins, red-winged blackbirds, grackles, Canada geese, these are just random mutations, and so the odds just tend to increase that you're going to get an individual that's going to show a partial albinism on it, or sometimes even complete albinism, which is, of course, the lack of pigments. It's sort of the roll of dice. It is rare, but especially when you get very large populations of birds, some of the more common ones, those odds just tend to increase that you're going to see an unusually marked individual among the group.
Yeah.
And obviously it sticks out quite a bit in the neighborhood.
Oh,
right.
Sure.
And there's a bird that if it does come back each year, there's one you'll know how long it lives from all the other robins because he's got those very distinguishing marks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and we also had a European goldfinch at our feeder over the winter.
Those have been showing up the last few years, and it appears that they're in the pet trade. And being a bird from Northern Europe, it's well adapted to our climate, so if they get out, just like the house finch from the Western United States, when those were released into the wild, they established very well and are now a common nesting bird in Wisconsin. I do have a little bit of a concern among some of these, and that is that here we've got a cousin species to our goldfinch. And hard to say what'll happen if that population should build up, and will there be competition among that and some of its close cousins? We also have a few reports in the last couple of years of a close relative of the chickadee from Europe called the great tit. And this has shown up at feeders and in people's backyards. And while these are attractive birds and they are into pet trade, once these things escape into the wild, very hard to manage something like that, and the consequences in terms of competition with what's already existing out there is entirely unknown. And I guess we wouldn't know it until it's almost too late, where the population has built up sufficiently, where what do you do with them anymore?
Right.
No. So, yeah, it's an attractive bird, and those sightings have been in the last 5 years a little bit more common around areas.
And, well, thank you very much. And if I can just say hi to Betsy in Dodgeville, because I know she listens to your show.
All right, Steve. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Susan in Lebanon is up next. Hi, Susan.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I've had a very active morning with the birds here also. I live on the Rock River, just northwest of Oconomowoc, in the little town of Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been feeding the birds for about 25 years, all four seasons, so I have a very, very active feeder, much like one of the lists that the gentleman quite a few callers ago now gave, everything from the hummingbirds all the way up to the large birds of prey and waterfowl. So, but I have one that's been elusive to me with its call, and I'm guessing on it. I have on my feeder a flock of cowbirds come in, along with some red-winged blackbirds and starlings, but they scatter very quickly. But there's a call that just within the last two years I haven't been able to identify, and I'm wondering if I give a stab at it, if you might be able to guess on it.
Give it a shot.
We're all ears.
Okay, it's kind of like a bubbling water. It's kind of a gloop, gloop.
Hmm.
Bloop, bloop.
Well, cowbird does have a very high-pitched, kind of a bubbly call at times, especially when the male displays to the female.
Mm-hmm.
And with our kind of cool spring this year, it seems like the cowbirds and red-winged blackbirds have been even more common visitors to our feeders than usual. So just off the top of my head, since you did mention cowbirds, I'm guessing that might be the sound of a cowbird.
Okay.
That'd be my guess as well. The more common call is that real high, and then a descending whistle you'll hear from them. But as Noel says, during courtship, very mm-hmm. bubbly, somewhat of a short, musical little call.
Well, and living on the river, and we've had some flooding, and you know, with the blooping, at first I thought it was coming from the water, and then it was too close. It was
yeah.
just outside my window at the feeder, and then I try and sneak up, and then I've got the scattering of the birds and trying to catch which one it might be. So, good. That gives me a clue.
Yep, probably a cowbird. Thanks, Susan.
Yes, thank you.
Appreciate the call. And Lori in Juneau, I believe, is our next caller. So let me find the right button here. Hi, Lori.
Hi there. We had several bird sightings this spring, and we're just right downstream from Horicon Marsh, about 7 miles on a bay of Lake Sinisippi. And we've had the bald eagle pair there for the past, since 2000, actually. And this year they've had 3 eaglets and in the nest right now. They're a lot of fun to watch. And just down across the bay from them, we have blue heron rookery there. And I couldn't tell. I don't think there's egrets in there this year, but there are herons flying in and out, and it's kind of hard to get a count on that. But and then we have about, I think we got some of your white pelicans, Bill, because we've got about 45 to 60 white pelicans. And I almost thought they were nesting back in the real marshy kind of farm land back there. And I was real curious if they were nesting. I was wondering how you can kind of tell. I suppose you'd have to get binoculars and stand, and I'd have to take a little skiff or something back there.
What do you think, Bill?
Well, actually, there was a report from Lake Sinisippi 2 years ago, I believe it was, of what looked like possible nesting, that a number of birds were on the north end of the lake
mm-hmm.
and on a small island area. And the story I heard was somebody in motorboat, some young kid was going around the area and somewhat harassing the birds. Whether they were just resting or roosting there or whether it was a true nesting attempt, hard to say, but you've got a very similar landscape to Horicon Marsh, especially on that north end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of your islands there have trees on it, but up in the north, if you've got some decent islands or mats of cattail that
yeah.
are dry enough, high enough.
I'm thinking this is where the cattail kind of transitions into the low farmland there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering maybe that I'll have to try to get a look at it. Anyway,
I would suggest that between yourself and some of the neighbors who may be motoring up that way, keep
yeah.
an eye on it to see if there's any sign. Obviously, like we said as well, you know, we've also got the non-breeders, and from Horicon, it's not a far flight down to Lake Sinisippi, so
no.
Certainly it's a common loafing and fishing site as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I would suspect that it's at least an opportunity for them to nest there, and yeah, keep a good close eye open, because I don't get down there often enough to check, and I'd be curious.
Now, I saw a couple of bobolinks on the prairie. We have 18 acres of native prairie, and I saw them like 7 years ago, and I hadn't seen them since. I had to go look up what they were, but they're so unusual. They look like kind of small magpies, very distinctive. I was curious if those are very common.
In our grasslands, they were very common. We still see them in some of the restored prairies, and they're easily lured into some of the shorter grass, especially the alfalfa fields. But production there is oftentimes rather poor because as we get now to the end of May, 1st of June, that clover is getting ripe, and it'll be the early harvest of that, which coincides with the peak of their nesting season. So while they may be lured into those sites, they're not always successful.
Uh-huh.
Along the east side of Horicon Marsh and some of the established prairie sites there,
mm-hmm.
they're doing quite well, good populations. In fact, I drove around this morning a little bit, do some birding on my way in, and they were just chattering away in a couple of fields along
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, they're
there.
Really distinctive looking, aren't they? And I guess they
great
come
look
down
at and
from
fun
Central
to
America
to.
Or something. I didn't realize that they migrated, you know, from somewhere. I think it's even South America. I can't
yes,
remember.
Yes, all the way down to Argentina and southern
okay,
Brazil.
Yeah.
So they've got to go over the rainforest to get to that northern pampas area because they're grassland birds.
Yeah.
Long way
yeah.
to go.
Yeah, I have a friend also back on your pelicans, Tom Schaefer from Hartford. He was visiting someone who lives on Lake Sinisippi, and he has confirmed pelicans breeding there. So,
Oh, good.
Oh, we do.
Good.
Okay.
I kind of thought they were. It sure looked like they were all lounging around back there. And, oh, that's neat. Okay. Now, does anybody keep account? Is there anything? Because we have a prairie house like vacation retreat, and people come and they watch the birds. Should we keep account, or is there any place to report it to for the eagles and all that kind of stuff?
Well, for the eagle nests, yes, we do keep account there. And in fact, we've got 4 nests in Dodge County. We've got observers on each of those. So we've contacted some of the neighbors who are kind of adopted those birds and keep a close eye. They'll give us the production figures of how many young are out each year. And otherwise, there's also eBird, the electronic bird checklist, where people can put their daily checklists in.
Okay.
That's a wonderful site to keep your own records and contribute to a much larger database. Lots of places for people to keep records, or just for yourself. Just keep a list of what you've got in the backyard, what you observe yourself.
Yeah, just an observation list. That's what I do.
Yeah.
It was pretty amazing because that eagle nest fell down last August in a storm, and they rebuilt it in about 4 months. So it was really amazing that they're still there. So.
Now, I'd recommend you go to Wisconsin eBird to enter all your sightings. Wisconsin's one of the leading states for the number of checklists that people are submitting. That's eBird. It's ebird.org/content/wi.
Okay.
And it'll take you to the website, and there's a way to enter. You can. It's a great way to keep your property list or a hotspots list or your Wisconsin list or any kind of information. And they also are encouraging people not just to put a checklist, but also put numbers of birds that they're seeing. So it's a great way to add to the database for bird populations.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think people would enjoy doing that. Great. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Lori. Thanks for calling. And Greg in Minocqua, it's your turn. Hi, Greg.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question in regards to red-headed woodpeckers. We have them eating from the black sunflower feeder, but I was wondering if there's anything else that we could put out, maybe help them out. I'm fairly certain they're nesting, just in the backyard close by. And
well, you're lucky to have them.
That's what I've been told. It's not real common in this area.
Yeah, Noel, common?
Yeah, you are lucky. It seemed like this is a bird that pretty much moves out of Wisconsin during the wintertime, and it seemed like we had more red-headed woodpecker sightings this spring. I know I've seen more, so I don't know if they had a good overwintering where they had good production last year, and we're seeing a lot of red-headed moving back into the state. But it's certainly a bird that needs to be conserved and managed as much as possible. And they're really not a real common feeder bird. They will come in for corn and other grains, but by now they're going to be starting to think about nesting, and they're going to be moving more to an invertebrate insect and other types of soft-bodied critters for food. So the main thing you really do is try to provide snags in an oak savanna area, open oak areas preferably is the kind of habitat they prefer, but maintain some dead trees so they can find adequate nest cavities.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, there's plenty of those because the pileateds have opened up lots of houses in the last few years.
Cool.
But I didn't know if there was something else I could put out. They were coming one to the front to the seed feeder and one to the back to a dying maple tree that I have. And now, the last few days, there's only been the one, so I'm wondering if perhaps, they're starting the egg hatching part, and they're taking turns.
Could very well be. I know that some of the woodpeckers have been nesting. We heard a nest full of babies on a field trip over by Leopold Center yesterday. So the woodpeckers are definitely are nesting, and some have babies already. So
nothing really that I could put out that would maybe give them extra help?
No, I think they'll be able to, if they're in the area, they're going to be able to find adequate invertebrates to feed on from now on. So
mm-hmm.
Great.
All right.
Thank you.
Keep enjoying them.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. And let's see. We'll take some more calls in just a minute. Our guest, Noel Cutright, past president and current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, also senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas, and Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR's Bureau of Wildlife Management. He works out of the Horicon Marsh National Wildlife Area. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Really pleased to be talking birds today with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, Larry Mueller here, and really happy to have you listening in. Give us a call with your questions at 800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And let's go to Bill in Madison next. Bill, hello.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
There are far too many raptors getting far too many of our beautiful, sweet songbirds. These raptors are doing a drastic population diminution on partridge, songbirds, and, Larry, bald eagles get spawning muskies. What do you say there, Larry?
Well, I don't know about that. I think I'm going to have to, first turn to Bill Volkert for a comment.
Well, first of all, keep in mind that the birds that we have out there have grown up with and lived for an awful long time with predators. The predators oftentimes are really culling a lot of those flocks, taking the young unaware and also the injured or sick. And what we're really looking at is, while it can be disheartening to say have a Cooper's hawk swoop down and take a colorful cardinal right off the feeder, what we really need to look at in the long run is the populations of birds. Sure, it's always difficult when an individual dies and something that we've become attached to, and nobody likes to see that. But when we're looking at the conservation of species, we're looking at recognizing that they're born each year, they're dying each year, but can the population maintain itself? And what we're really seeing is what's killing birds, so to speak, or the real impacts to the losses of so many is simply the loss of the habitat. The raptors that are out there, the other predators, they've always, preyed on a certain number of those birds, but we had a big enough stage for nature to carry all this out on. What's really the problem is the loss of nesting habitat here in the United States, the loss of overwintering sites down in the tropics where many of these birds go to, and the obstacles that we're raising for these birds, such as the communication towers, our high-rise buildings, windows on our houses, feral house cats, increased a nest predation from both raccoons that are out there, jays and grackles, as well as the cowbird who puts its eggs in it. Those are the real problems for birds, and it isn't any one single one of these things that is leading to the diminishing of some bird populations, but it's the culmination of more and more pressures in the environment as we're using land for ourselves and leaving less and less for the birds to survive. The raptors and the birds have lived together for a long time, and they get by just fine if we just give them enough room for all of those to coexist in healthy population numbers.
Thanks for calling. I got an email from Joe in Cottage Grove who says he's been seeing a lot of purple triangle-shaped boxes hanging from trees in various locations along many of the county roads east of Madison. Boxes are about 2 feet by 6 inches.
Mm-hmm.
Any idea what they are?
Gypsy moth and emerald ash borer.
Yep.
Yep. Those are the insect population monitoring, and they have an insect pheromone. Essentially, the sexual attractant smell that they put out has been synthesized, and this is a way of sampling those populations, where they are and where they are building up as a population problem. And basically, the pheromone is the scent. They fly around, they get attracted, and you've got like a flypaper inside. They get stuck to it, and it's simply the sample of where they are present, where they're not, or where they're abundant. We need to look at some control measures.
I just saw my first one yesterday, matter of fact, and I was kind of curious. I know that for many years we've been putting out small yellow traps for gypsy moths, little triangular traps that people would put on around the state for tracking gypsy moths, but now that we have another invasive species that we have to be concerned about, we have gone to a much larger, different colored size trap, and be interesting to see if we turn up any of the borers in the state.
Yeah, we hope we don't, but we're probably going to eventually. Jackie in Lake Como, your turn. Hi, Jackie.
Hi there. I had something very unusual and exciting happen in the late winter in March in Lake Como, which is near Lake Geneva. It's an old subdivision with lots of big trees. I saw at very close range twice a harrier hawk. And I wondered if you could talk a little about that. The one I saw, I believe, was a female. And what was so distinctive and threw me is I was looking from about 20 feet away inside the house at a bird that looked definitely like a hawk, about 18 inches tall, I'd guess. But it had this face that reminded you of an owl because of the round shape to the feathering. And it was white and brown. And a couple of days before I started seeing this hawk, a large bird flew over me, kind of low, maybe 30, 40 feet off the ground, and it was, all I could see was the underside, and it was white to dove gray, and I'm wondering if that might have been the male, and I didn't know if they would have been living as a pair at that time of the year or not.
All right. Well, let's start with Noel. Noel?
Well, northern harriers are a species that breed in grasslands primarily, and they're not a woodland hawk at all, but they would certainly soar over and fly over, you know, areas where you have woods. As you point out, there's a difference in plumage between the male and the female. The male is very gray above and whitish below with black wingtips, and the female is much more barred underneath, much browner in the body, so they look
very
quite
barred.
Differently. Very long tails, but both the male and female will have that white rump patch, which is very diagnostic for northern harriers. During the wintertime, they would not be paired up, so they were probably not doing any kind of courtship, unless it was, you know, late winter or early spring. They might start...
I think it was late March, if I'm not mistaken.
It was late March. They could definitely be starting to pair up, so it's possible that was a male and female of a pair.
Well, and she landed twice on a brush pile that I have, and it's, oh, maybe 15 or 20 feet from my bird feeders. So she landed and I think was looking to see if there was anything interesting feeding at the time, maybe. I'm not sure.
If you saw it perched in a woods on a brush pile, I would say it was not a northern harrier. As I pointed out, they're an open fields bird. They forage by flying low over and looking for primarily rodents in the grass and on the ground. They're not a species that would hunt in a woodland or even go into a woodsy area where there's many trees at all.
Well, it's a subdivision, and we do have, you know, we're real close to the lake, and a good chunk of the lake is very open and kind of marshy, you know, protected area, too. So I wasn't sure if they worked with that. But, boy, you know, I got two really close looks at her because I was right in front of the French doors.
Yeah, they do have an interesting face appearance. I think you described that pretty well. And
yeah, I mean,
they love marshes and wetlands. This is as I pointed out on grasslands. So I you know, depending if you're just on the edge, they might occasionally come into that kind of habitat.
Yeah,
that's what I'm thinking.
All right,
well, thank you.
Thanks, Jackie, for calling. And well, let's go to Chuck in Waukesha next. Hi, Chuck.
Hello there. Thank you. First, I have a comment and then a question. I was driving up from Indiana about a month ago, and I saw two whooping cranes came right over the highway, Highway 65, as I was going north. And so I went on the website, and I found out that's their flyway. So I guess it's not wasn't that unusual. But my question is, when I was a youngster living out in the suburban areas, I always marveled at the eastern meadowlarks, and I have not seen an eastern meadowlark in 5 years. And I was wondering,
yeah,
is that population going bad?
Bill?
Well, eastern meadowlark, actually I should mention the western meadowlark is one that's declined even more so in Wisconsin. We're a little bit on that eastern fringe of that bird. But meadowlarks in general, yeah, those populations have gone down some, and it's been largely the changes in farming practices. And here is a bird that was originally of the prairies, like our bobolink. And they moved into what we refer to as surrogate grasslands, so not a true native prairie, but pasture land, hay fields, this type of man-created or man-made type of a grassland environment. And what's happened is more recently we've seen, first of all, the lack of pasturing of cattle, so we don't just let them roam out in the grasslands where the birds can coexist with them, and also for the high nutrition, these clover crops that we've seen over the last 20, 30 years become very prominent as we shift diet for the cattle in springtime. Right about the time we get to the peak of the nesting effort, right now is also when the first hay mowing takes place. Now, Conservation Reserve Program, CRP program, under the Farm Bill, did a tremendous job of idling the most erodible farmland, putting into permanent grass cover. And we saw quite a few grassland birds take to it. So northern harrier, our marsh hawk we talked about, those populations have come back quite well. Bobolinks respond to it, and meadowlarks as well. But we also find that, say, you mentioned while you were living in suburbs, think back a little bit, though. You know, 30 years ago, some of those city suburbs were right on the edge of the farmland, and what we had then was still some of that grassland habitat right along the edge of residential areas. As those have grown and we paved over more, we've pushed those birds out a little further away from some of the metropolitan areas. But, yeah, it is a bird that has diminished some in Wisconsin, and it's changing the grassland habitat out there.
Yeah. Noel, a comment?
As Bill pointed out, one of the changes we're seeing is change in land use. And I used to tell people here in Ozaukee County where I lived, there were more meadowlarks along the I-43 grasslands than anywhere else in the county. But as we started having grasslands being put back onto the landscape as part of the various farm programs that are available to farmers, we've seen an increase here in Ozaukee County in eastern meadowlarks. But now with, again, changes in policies and the pressure for more corn being produced to go into food and also to ethanol especially, we're seeing many of these grasslands now going back into row cropping, and it's definitely going to affect, you know, local populations of things like bobolinks and meadowlarks and upland sandpipers and some of the other species that really depend upon grassland. So
yeah,
we're going to see these fluctuations. As Bill pointed out, it declined significantly. Over the last 40 years, they've declined here in Wisconsin 2.5% per year. You know, 2.5% doesn't sound very much.
But that's a lot. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. We need to take a quick break here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On this Memorial Day, we're discussing resident and migrant bird watching here in Wisconsin. Larry Mueller here, really pleased to have with us Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, former president and current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. Also with us today by phone, Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR's Bureau of Wildlife Management. He resides at the Horican Marsh National Wildlife Area. And if you've been listening, you know these guys really know their birds. And it's always great to have them with us today. And I hope you'll join in. If you have some questions, some sightings, or whatever that you'd like to talk about relating to birds, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Back after the news. Talking birds, migrant birds, and bird watching in Wisconsin, answering your questions today. Larry Mueller here with my two guests by phone, Noel Cutright of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology and Bill Volkert of the Department of Natural Resources. A couple of nice guys who come by pretty often on holidays to talk with us about birds, and we're really pleased to have them back again today. And Noel, you were talking a little about meadowlarks, and when I kind of cut you off there at the just before the news, any other comments?
No, I think it's just a significant decline we've seen in this species. And Bill mentioned western meadowlark. Back in the mid-60s, or late 60s, I should say, the western meadowlark was the seventh most common breeding bird in Wisconsin. And now,
wow,
I'm sure it's not even in the top 50, and I'm not sure where it would rank, but it'd be way down the list as we have lost even more western meadowlark habitat, and that species even have declined even more drastically than the eastern meadowlark. So I guess I'm not sure what the picture holds for those species, especially as we go more and more toward row cropping and taking a lot of our grasslands out of that particular type of habitat.
Yeah.
Well, it also brings something else interesting to mind, is while we can do a lot in conservation to set aside certain critical areas for birds, keep in mind that a lot of the land is private holding, and especially agricultural land and other private holding there, even forest land, such as production forests and so forth, a lot of it is dictated by the economics. And so with that, we can try to do an awful lot to buy certain critical areas and set it aside, but those are sort of postage stamp areas on a huge landscape, and birds are scattered across wide areas of the United States. And so with that, a lot of these things are to sway a little bit with how economics and trends start to affect it in land use, and they come and they go accordingly.
Yeah.
And we hope that we can offset some of that with good conservation effort, and maybe even, say, as we did with the Farm Bill beginning in 1985, put a conservation provision in there to consider the impact of agriculture and other land uses.
Yeah. Well, Sue in Duluth has a question for you guys, so I'm going to turn to her next. Sue, hello. Thank you for waiting.
Hello. Well, I was glad to. Yesterday, I was on Madeline Island for a couple of days, and I saw a large white bird flying overhead with long wings and its neck stretched out. So I think that rules out herons and cranes, but, or not cranes, but herons at least. And I did not see any color on the head or at the tips of the wings. I can't say for sure it wasn't there because I wasn't using binoculars, but I was wondering if you have a guess as to what that might have been.
Well, Noel, you want to take a guess first?
You said you saw no black on the wingtips at all?
I can't say for sure it wasn't there, but I did not see it.
Yeah, there's several birds like the whooping crane and white pelicans and so forth that have black on the wing, and then there's a great egret that are all white wings. That's really kind of a critical thing to see. Was it great blue heron size, or was it a pretty large-sized bird?
It seemed to be pretty large, yes.
Oh.
But I wouldn't say for sure that it didn't have black wingtips. It was just a fleeting glance, and I don't know. I just...
Bill, any comments from you?
Well, Madeline Island seems far north for egrets.
Right. And pelicans and whooping cranes.
Yeah,
so.
a lot of those. You know, even sandhill cranes sometimes under certain lighting can look quite light in color.
Definitely have sandhill cranes there.
Sometimes I've seen them when they look, they tend to get a little more brownish in spring, but they do retain somewhat of a gray color. And when that light hits it at just the right angle, oftentimes they look extremely light. That's a possibility.
That's a possibility, yeah.
Okay.
Something to think about there, Sue.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Keep those bananas handy 24 hours a day.
Thanks a lot for calling. Marilyn in Kansasville, it is your turn next. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Since the 1980s, which seems an awfully long time ago, I've been a volunteer at the Richard Long State Recreation Area. And when I first began there, one of the sightings that we had, and people would come specifically to see it, was the yellow-headed blackbird with its most unusual call. And in the past, I would say maybe 4 or 5 years, it is no longer with us. And I was wondering if any of you knew the status of that bird and where it can be seen. What we thought was so neat was because we thought perhaps that Richard Bong was about the farthest east that you would see that bird. And, of course, now we don't have it at all. So I was wondering what you knew about its status.
Well, let's see. Noel?
As you point out, Bong used to be a really wonderful location in southeastern Wisconsin to see yellow-headed blackbirds. This is a more western species, and it's really a species of the deep water marshes and the prairie pothole regions of western Minnesota through the Dakotas and up into the prairie provinces. But there's a number of locations here in Wisconsin where you can find good populations of yellow-headed blackbirds. I was out in Columbia County this weekend and saw them in Chenenberg's Marsh, and there's other locations. And, of course, Bill probably lives or works in the area where there's the largest breeding population of yellow-headed blackbirds anywhere in the state. I don't know if you have any feeling for the trends and numbers in Horicon. Are they pretty much steady from year to year, Bill?
Well, what I notice is they seem to have a real requirement for a certain density of cattails over deep water.
Right.
And so what happens is the population moves around depending on changes in cattail. Lack of muskrats, they tend to grow real thick, and if you have a drought year with it, it becomes too shallow for them. High populations of muskrats eat them out. Occasionally we'll do a periodic burning to try to rejuvenate the cattail. And they're semi-colonial, and those colonies tend to move around a little bit. This year, the group up by Highway 49 has been more sparse. And we used to have them straight out from the field office. Now they moved over toward the Bachhuber flowage. And so there is a little bit of local movement. I wonder if that isn't what happened at Bong. Being a smaller wetland, I'm guessing that the conditions probably changed and they weren't able to move any further and just simply packed up and found something else more suitable.
Now, I should mention that Bill wrote the species account for the yellow-headed blackbird in the Atlas book, Larry,
yeah.
So
yeah.
He's probably more knowledgeable about yellow-headed blackbirds than anyone else in the state.
Well, I'm glad that they are still thriving somewhere. If you would like to send some back down to us, we would be most appreciative. But I'm sure that there, when you mentioned the cattails, yes, I can see where that the area that they were hanging out has decreased in cattail.
Yeah.
So I believe that's probably why they left us. Well, I thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much, Marilyn, for calling. Appreciate your call. Got an email from Nan, and she asks this question. How do we deal with concerns on a small lake with people disturbing loons through intentional damage and refusing to respect no wake? We frequent Nelligan Lake and Little Nelligan Lake, and people are very destructive. How can we help? And Bill, I'll turn that to you.
Well, Project Loon Watch started a number of years ago, and basically it's both a tally and sort of monitoring of the loon population and public information at the boat landings. And one of the problems for loons is that the peak of the nesting season coincides with the peak of our summer recreation, especially water-based recreation. So at the very time when they need peace and quiet and undisturbed area is when we get people on the lakes. And where you do have a loon population, you've got to certainly give them room. And one of the problems is oftentimes people sort of love them to death, where there's this intrigue. They canoe and motor up to them. They chase them around. They tire them out. They separate them from the young. You've got to watch them from a distance. You've got to give them some room. As far as, you know, one bad actor on the lake, whether through a lake association, a little bit of local patrolling, a little bit more urging of information, or perhaps working with a local warden might be the best thing. And all it takes is one person out there to chase those loons off. And they're also very specific to their territories. They come back to the same favorite lake year after year after year. And while we assume, of course, the loon to be the symbol of the far north woods, we used to have them 100 years ago nesting in southern Wisconsin. We just simply crowded them out of here. And that's why it's important, where they remain yet in the northern part of our state, to make sure we give them the room they need and the peace and quiet and watch them from a distance. And rather than motor right up or paddle up on top of them, take your binoculars along and sit back and give them the room they need. And like all wildlife watching, watch a little for their behavior, because they'll tell you when you're getting too close. When they start, the head is very erect, they're looking alert, they're getting concerned, they're swimming away, they're diving, they're becoming frightened, that's time to back off. We want to enjoy it. We want to encourage people to watch birds and enjoy our wildlife, but you got to give them the room they need to be able to raise their family and their young, too, at this time of year.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, get in touch with your local warden if all else fails. Hopefully that person or persons can be brought to justice, so to speak.
Yeah, and Project Loon Watch is coordinated out of Northland College in Ashland, so they would be a great people to contact. And they deal with this sort of issue all the time, so I would contact Project Loon Watch out of the Sigurd Olson Environmental Institute in Northland, and I'm sure they can provide some help to you.
Yep. Jim in Cumberland is up next. Jim, hello to you.
Hi, guys. I live in an area in northeastern Polk County, where there are a lot of trumpeter swans. And I prided myself through the years in the fall and the spring identifying flying swans as being trumpeters or tundras by the call they make. But this spring, in a nearby cornfield, there were 150 to 300 swans for several days. And when I talked to people about them, and I said, I think those are trumpeter swans, they said, no, it wouldn't be that many. They must be tundra swans. So now I'm wondering, do we really have migrating trumpeter swans in Wisconsin, or are they all tundra swans?
Bill?
Well, the trumpeter swan is a bird that's been reintroduced into the upper Midwest. And there's always been a population out west and up into Alaska, and we got our eggs from Alaska. And for a 10-year release program, our biologists went to Alaska, worked with the fish and game people, brought back some eggs, incubated them in Milwaukee County Zoo area, raised them to as immature birds, and then put them out in the wild. The first place we let them go was in far northwest Wisconsin, and that's because Minnesota had started to release just a few years earlier, so you wanted to bolster their population. So you're in the area of some of the original release of trumpeter swans, And in the last few years, the goal, by the way, was to have 20 nesting pair by the year 2000. We exceeded that at that point, and the last few years we've been over 75 to about 90 nesting pair. So the population is building, especially in the west central northwest part of the state and in the north central where we had some other releases. The tundra swan, or what years ago was called whistling swan, is a migrant, and they come here usually around, say, mid-March until about early April, mid-April is when they're pulling out. Our tundra trumpeter swans are really local nesting birds. They're not. There's no population north of us that they're migrating, staging here, and then moving beyond very far. Those are going to be your local nesting birds. The tundra swan, however, is a bird that comes from Chesapeake Bay. We'll actually see them coming over Lake Michigan into the marshes and shallow flooded fields and so forth. They'll fatten up here, and they'll head up toward Hudson Bay. Is a bit of a population, and most of them go all the way to the Arctic Ocean coast of the Yukon and Alaska. This is a tremendous migration up to 4,000 miles.
Yeah.
So if you're seeing these birds during that, say, mid-March to mid-April, right in that window, depending on when we're getting our ice melt and the birds are starting to move, those are the big flocks of tundras coming through. But we do have an increasing number of trumpeters. A simple way to do it is, well, by the time you get to the end of April, any big swan you're going to see is either the non-native mute or our trumpeter, since the tundras have moved on.
Okay.
All right.
Thank
While
you.
They're both here, it could be a little confusing.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling, Jim. Appreciate it. Mike in La Crosse, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Yeah, I've got some questions. You mentioned something earlier about the purple ash borer. Do we have that in Wisconsin?
Oh, emerald ash borer, yes. We do not have it. And well, we haven't identified it yet, have we, Bill?
No. The big outbreak was in lower Michigan. It's gotten into northern Indiana, and I think it was last year or year before, northeast Illinois had reported it. They're trying to kind of hold a line on it. They did do a little bit of injury of trees in the far southeast part of the state because they tend to go to injured trees, so they slash a few sample trees just to see if they would lure them in. Now we've synthesized the pheromone, so we're trying a trapping program. They move about 5 to 10 miles a year, which doesn't sound a lot, but 10 years, now you've got a 100-mile advance on them. And so it is a serious concern for us. Because, again, we don't know what that means, not only to say the ash tree in general, but what does that do to the forest composition and for the birds and other animals that live there? We don't need them.
Right, and that was my question. I think, like with the gypsy moth years ago, didn't they introduce some kind of a wasp or something that preyed on the larva?
For gypsy moth, what they're really using there is a bacterium. They call it BT, Bacillus thuringiensis, and it's a soil bacteria that gets into the caterpillar, and that's what's aerial applied. More recently, a different fungus has been used as well. So that's the biological control. And basically, we're trying to live with gypsy moths, but keep it from going to these tremendous eruptions when they just gnaw the entire forest. So we can't ever get rid of them all, but we're trying to hold the population into somewhat manageable levels to try to sort of keep a lid on it. And there's something unusual with that population that all of a sudden they just erupt, and that's where they defoliate huge areas of forest. So we've got them in eastern Wisconsin. The gypsy moth is here. Emerald ash borer is not yet. We'll see what we can do, how fast we can continue to develop some sort of a means to control them, and before they get here and devastate our forest.
Yeah. Thank you, Mike, for calling. Al in Nosium, is that correct, Lake?
Yes, Nosium Lake. I have a question for Mr. Volker, first off, because his name came up in the history of this cabin. Do you have a relative by the name of John Volker?
No. It's a somewhat common German name, but I'll tell you that my parents and two older brothers were actually born in Germany. All my relatives live in East Central Germany. Other Volkerts, they may be distant relatives that may have immigrated a long time ago or just shared the name. But
okay.
As far as immediate family, no, it's just our family here.
Well, we're on a lake that we're the only cabin on the lake. It's about a 30-acre lake. We're a loon-protected lake. In fact, our mated pair showed up with three chicks last week.
Good.
Wonderful.
And they're doing great, and we do our best at keeping everybody as far away from them as possible.
Excellent.
But we have a feeder out here, and we get probably about five or six blue jays a day and a couple of red-headed woodpeckers. But we started seeing a bird that I've never, really beautiful bird, but I've never seen before.
And we got the book out, and it's called A Rose-Breasted Grosbeak.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Are those very common up here?
Rose-breasted grosbeak is a forest bird, and it is a true neotropical migrant. He goes down to Central America. They usually come back during the first week of May, and especially a year like this where we had cool weather and the leaves were barely emerging. In fact, even now, almost the end of May, the leaves are in southern Wisconsin are just a little more than half out. We get a little bit of rain and some heat on this. That'll change overnight. But you'll commonly see them coming to the backyards and even the feeders the first couple of days when they arrive. The natural food is not that abundant, and like the caller had mentioned earlier about his red-headed woodpeckers, they'll come in and take a little bit of food off the feeders at first, but once the natural food's available, they tend to live off of that. And I get questions commonly about the indigo bunting, rose-breasted grosbeak, and some of these migrants that come to the feeders when they first arrive, and then where do they go? Basically, they move up into the treetops. And now, as we're seeing the leaves getting denser and thicker in the trees, most of your bird identification is going to have to be by song. So you got to tune your ears up a little bit. You'll hear them up overhead, but this is typical kind of strategy of somewhat tropical birds. Brilliant colors, but you have to watch you're not then making yourself as a prey item. So if you can live in the densest canopy, like a scarlet tanager, same thing. You can be up there and then you vocalize to announce your territory or to find a mate, and you stay hidden from view, which makes them hard for us to see.
Yeah, if you look at the map in the Breeding Bird Atlas book, the whole state is blue, which means they were confirmed just in every corner of the state. So they're definitely a species that's distributed throughout.
Yep.
Well, they're very pretty.
Yeah,
absolutely.
They sure.
Very pretty.
Yep.
They sing a song that sounds very similar to a robin. It's a little softer and sweeter, so it's a very pleasant song, too.
Yeah.
It's a little bit more back-and-forth rhythm. And they have a squeak note that is diagnostic and an excellent description. It sounds like the squeaking of a sneaker on a gym floor, just when you kick it once.
Yeah.
And that'll get your ear.
The Blue Jays don't like them. I know that. When they come to the pile, the Blue Jays scatter.
Well, the Blue Jays tend to kind of mob feeders and take them for themselves, but that guy's got a big beak for to fend them off a little bit. So I think that they tend to wait their turn.
Thanks, Al.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it. Tom in Kansasville, it's your turn next. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how you doing? I go to Bong just to relax. I'm there right now. And I noticed this year three pairs of mute swans. And I'm wondering two things. Are they likely to breed? We're going to see little mute swans. I'd like to see them, but I've heard that the mute swan can be kind of cause damage to the are you still there?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Can cause damage to the relatively small wildlife area that Bong is. And I just wonder, will they tend to breed? And would three pairs cause damage to the recreational area here?
Bill?
Well, mute swans, they are a bird of northern Europe. And so, yes, they can breed in this climate. There's no doubt about that. And with the introduction of the trumpeter swan, they're serious competitors. While we don't have trumpeter swans right now in that part of the state, but we also know in smaller ponds that they can do a tremendous amount of damage to the aquatic vegetation. And we've been trying to remove the mute swans from some areas in Wisconsin. It isn't without controversy, of course.
Right.
That's the problem. And so it's more of a politically charged issue. And where we've got public interest and support, we have been actually removing the mute swans from areas essentially to protect the aquatic environment and give an opportunity for the trumpeter swans. Because you're going to have one of the swan, and the mute swan tends to be the more aggressive.
Yeah.
So it is an issue, though, that is a little touchy to implement, and with that we're moving rather delicately on that. But the more people understand that mute swans are non-native and somewhat unwanted in an ecosystem, I think we can get the support for taking the necessary measures.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate your call. Thanks very much for calling. Irene in Monona, maybe a quick question from you. Hi, Irene.
Hi. I have a comment and a couple of questions. Thank you for...
We've only got about 30 seconds.
So. Okay. I'm standing in a second story of my house looking out my bedroom, and that's where I usually see the scarlet tanager.
Ah.
And so what do you think about the treetops? Are they very common in the Monona area?
They're not uncommon at all. It's a neotropical migrant that are back in Wisconsin now, and they breed in deciduous woodlands throughout the state. So they're not uncommon at all. Good sighting, though.
Yeah, it's a great sighting, and thank you very much for calling. And Noel and Bill, thank you both so much for taking another holiday with us. The lines are filled the whole time you're here, and it's always a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Enjoy it, Larry. And maybe really Sue had it. A swan up in Madeline Island. She should consider that.
All right. That's possible. Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. Noel, Ozaukee County resident, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Bill Volkert with the DNR's Bureau of Wildlife Management. Great guys, and it's always a great pleasure to have them. And we always kind of do this in honor of Sam Robbins, who was a regular guest on this program for many, many holidays in the past. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.